I call this meeting to order. Please stand for the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May we have the roll call?
Councilmember Deedy?
Here.
Councilmember Oglesby?
Here.
Councilmember Edelman?
Here.
Councilmember Stout?
Here.
Councilmember Wisnowski?
Here.
So I would ask for a motion to accept the agenda.
I move that we accept the agenda.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We have two presentations today. The first one is the Enumclaw School District FFA debating team, the issue of opening a mine in Black Diamond. So whoever wants to be the spokesperson, somebody get up to the microphone and state your name and your residence.
My name is Leah Perry, and I'm with the Enumclaw FFA chapter. We're an agriculture issues team, and we recently made it to state presenting this 15-minute speech about a local issue in our area, which is Black Diamond. Well, we encourage you guys to ask questions and that's like preparing us for our state competition coming up, and so just feel free to ask questions. Oh, and it's a skit, so this isn't actually like our position on the matter, so just keep that in mind.
And please speak up so we can all hear you.
Okay. Yeah. Don't be afraid to pick up that microphone.
It's okay. Being recorded.
I got it. It's okay. I'm going to ask the King 5 breaking news report. Protesters have gathered in Black Diamond, a small town located in Western Washington. Nestled in the foothills, Black Diamond offers its local population of just over 4,000 residents a warm, friendly, and rural atmosphere with amazing mountain views. Black Diamond was established in the late 1880s as a mining community and soon became one of the major coal exporters in the region. Here today in Black Diamond, the coal mining industry, the very industry which built this town, has caused a controversial thing for local businesses and residents. The Pacific Coastal Coal Company and current owner of the mine have declared that they are reopening the mine. As you can see by the team behind me, the locals are divided and passionate about this issue. Let's meet the man responsible for all this. Sir, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Gamer Gann, the owner of John Henry Mine, a citizen of Black Diamond, Washington. This mine has been under my family's possession since 1897. Black Diamond Mines have provided employment, materials for our local businesses, and a way of life for many generations. I think reopening this mine and helping Black Diamond find its way back to its roots is not only a good idea, but a great one. I can't wait.
Mr. McGann, I think what the people really want to know is, why are you reopening the mine? It's been inoperable for more than 20 years, so why now?
Well, this is simply a market timing-based decision. We tried to reopen the mine 10 years ago, but federal regulators would not apply without customers under contract. We now have those contracts, and since our product will be produced on-site, 60% will be shipped to the Lehigh Cement Plant in British Columbia, and the remaining 40% shipped to the Seattle Ash Grove Plant for mine production.
Excuse me, isn't this your last chance to renew your permit? Isn't that the reason you're reopening?
I know a lot of folks are upset by this. The truth is, everyone will benefit. With the higher prices of coal, the industry can afford its workers, pay its workers, higher wages, who can then put that money into local businesses, benefiting the overall economy.
It is so offensive that Mr. McGann here is pretending that the situation is beneficial for everyone from an economic standpoint, when clearly this is for his own personal wealth. How is that fair?
Excuse me, who are you?
My name is Aubrey Arnold, and I'm the local town historian. I was born and raised here in Black Diamond, Washington, and have been an official volunteer with the Black Diamond Museum since I was 23, when it first opened in 1982.
I love this town and love the fact that its beginnings are rooted in mining. But the past is the past, and it should stay that way. As for giving people more jobs, what good are jobs if they cause harm? Mining is considered one of the most dangerous occupations worldwide. Now, don't get me wrong, this town was once booming from this mine, but items like oil replaced coal because they were more efficient. The only reason Mr. McGann here wants this mine open is for his own personal use, and I will not stand for it.
So what is for my own personal wealth? It's my right as a business owner. My land is my mine.
Not good for the people? I'm Katie King, a local business owner. I know that if we open this mine, there'll be a tremendous increase in the small town's economy. Where are the workers going to go for their lunch break? Where will they fill up on gas? The mine is located 8 minutes from town. All those employees, locally sourced or not, will be putting their money into our restaurants, gas stations, and stores at the convenience.
I don't care that you'll be making money. This is about the safety and security of our town. There's a reason why we're the only active coal mining operation in the state. One coal-fired plant has the power to release over 3 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, an equivalent to chopping down over 150 million trees, not to mention the amount of damage it's going to have on our water resources.
Excuse me, ma'am. Who are you and how you're involved in this situation?
I'm environmental scientist Leah Perry, and I'm one of the environmental scientists that monitor this town. I've been following this case pretty closely and found the monumental impacts it has on our local and global economy. Environment. Every year that he mines is an equivalent to chopping down over 150 million trees. Open blast mining is a type of mining he is using to destroy this town's air quality. This damaging type of mining involves the use of explosives and gas pressure to release the coal underneath. As a result, toxic mining waste is released to the atmosphere.
The toxins that these mines are putting in the air doesn't only affect the environment around us, but the people who live near these mines. Our health can have negative reactions to pollutants caused by mining operations. The mines create a smog, which can affect everybody's health. This isn't only a health and safety risk to miners and employees.
All industrial operations produce smog. Your own car produces smog.
Excuse me, ma'am. Can you tell our viewers your name, please?
My name is Kayla Richardson. I'm a local resident of Black Diamond and a mother of four.
And just to clarify, you're also against this?
Of course I am against this. I know what the effects are to my children. When the mine is in operation, not only will it affect mine, but everybody else's children. With the mine being less than a mile away from the elementary school, I don't want my kids to be running around and then drop dead because they caught chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which causes their airways to close up. Unfortunately, many mining communities have been left with severe damages that cannot be fixed.
Excuse me, but you're being dramatic. We have taken every precaution needed to ensure prevent most of these illnesses. These permits I'm applying for come with regulations, such as only mining for a certain amount of time each week and only letting a little amount of pollutant into the air so it doesn't affect the public. We have regulations that we follow that help prevent these illnesses.
Black Diamond Mine can open up 30 jobs, and this is the best job opportunity that can give to me and to others. I don't care how dangerous it is, all jobs are dangerous at some point, and if President Staples out of it.
30 jobs? You're willing to destroy the environment over 30 jobs? You're willing to release methane into our town's atmosphere, which is 20 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, over 30 jobs, and a town of just over 4,000 people. 30 jobs doesn't seem like a good enough reason to destroy this environment.
I agree with Leah. When the mine was opened in 1936, it supplied jobs to 75 plus people. With the reopening, it only provide 30 jobs?
Well, this college degree, if you multiply 30 jobs on an annual given salary, according to the Bureau of Statistics, that equals $1,800,000. I may just be a coal miner or a blue-collar worker, but that's not like a lot of mine going through our local economy.
What's your history with this mine? How's it going to affect you?
My name is Trevor Pudwell, and I am or was a coal miner. And now I struggle to find work in our local community. The Black Diamond Mine can offer the average miner $60,000 to $70,000 a year. Right out of high school. And I'll be honest, I wasn't very good in high school. I got my high school diploma in 1995. I worked in the John Henry Black Diamond Mines for 4 years. After that, it closed in 1999, and life got hard. I was unemployed. Black Diamond doesn't offer many jobs to people like me, and now that dream, boy, that could be reopening.
I wasn't aware that this was a factor to consider. In my personal experience of being a journalist, I've seen many folks who have struggled with these modern world changes, just like replacing coal mining industry with alternative power sources and without any experience, like you said. Life is hard.
This is going to be very beneficial from an economic standpoint. Trevor is not the only local citizen who has hit hard times. Hard times mean tighter budgets, less spending, and a decrease in revenue being produced by our local economy. Anytime a larger operation like this takes place, the local community benefits. With this job, correct me if I'm wrong, Trevor, we owe more money to spend in local shops like mine.
No, you're absolutely right.
Not only is this bringing jobs and profit to business owners in town, but it'll bring in many available jobs for white workers who will work in this mine. They'll have a job for a full 7 years.
7 years is the perfect amount of time to destroy our environment and people's lives, Mr. McGann. This project will not bring revenue when all of your employees are ill with a possibly fatal disease because you thought it would be beneficial. Living in this town for as long as I have, I've witnessed several friends and family suffer from severe work-related injuries. Did you know that in 2015, there were 26 fatalities in the mining industry, with 11 of which being from coal mining? Also, in the United States, there were 4,517 injuries from coal mining. These aren't just small injuries either. These people can't even make it to work, Mr. McGann.
It is going to be conducted with delayed explosions, so the blast will be staggered instead of detonating all at once. But when you're mining coal, it is a risk you choose to take. Dealing with lung disease is something workers do when they sign up for this type of career.
Not only is this going to affect locally the miners working in the mines, but also globally our environment.
How is the company going to transport these shipments?
I've been researching the transportation method of Mr. McGann and found that he will be using trains, trucks, and ships to transport this large amount of coal through our country and other countries such as Canada. Pacific Coast Coal Company seeks to mine up to 90,000 tons of coal per year over a course of 6 years, adding up to over 500,000 tons of coal that will be shipped out and negatively affect the environment.
So the pollution is coming from all the trucks, trains, and ships. Who is responsible for the damage to the environment this might cause?
In the permit filled out by Pacific Coast Coal Company, there is a reclamation bond. A reclamation bond is a way to help restore some of the ecological destructions made by this mine.
See, I care about the environment and my permit. I included a reclamation bond.
Yeah, you included the reclamation bond in the permit, but if all goes wrong and this does destroy the environment, it could cost the federal government over $5 million.
And what's going to happen after the coal is mined and shipped? Air pollutants caused by coal power fire plants include sulfur dioxide. This leads to smog, acid rain, and toxins that not only do environmental damages, but also affects your respiratory and cardiovascular effects.
It's not my intention to hurt the environment or children, but it's my right and...
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. Again, I am on to an epic John Henry mine located in Black Diamond, Washington. Obviously, this is going to be a pretty heated debate against the reopening of this mine because of how important the preservation of this town is to its citizens. Over here, we have the people who are against the mine reopening because it's going to cause multiple respiratory health issues for the citizens, damage the environment, and cause safety concerns for the supposed miners. And over here, we have Mr. McGann, who swears this is a great economic opportunity for this town, along with an increase in jobs, and is going to bring in high revenue for local business owners such as Katie King. That is all for now. We will keep you updated as the story develops further.
Does anybody have any questions?
I would like to make a comment. I just thought it was fascinating that you presented various sides of the issue, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
So are you debating this at school, this particular subject?
Yes.
Or?
Well, so okay. In FFA, this team is called Ag Issues, and we compete and go to state, which is at WSU, and it's just our topic.
Yeah, so we just competed at sub-districts against a couple other schools around here, like White River. We came out in second place, now we're moving on to state, and we'll compete against all of the other Ag Issue teams at state convention in May.
So are you, with what you presented today, so I didn't hear, how they're going to handle the truck traffic, where is all that going to, is it going to go on? Is it called Hobart Road? Is it going to go on Highway 169? Where's the transportation for all those trucks? How many trucks per day are going to leave the mine itself? I mean, those are all good things to discuss.
And that's exactly the question we're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so those are safety issues for the citizens of Black Diamond, for the homeowners up at Morgan Creek who live right next door to the entrance. You know, if they're trucking them out through Ravensdale, that's going through a small little community out there. If they're bringing them back out here onto 169 off of that road, what's the safety, you know, precautions they got to go there? We do have a roundabout coming in, but that's still a little ways off. So those are all, you know, everything that you talked about are really good. Mm-hmm. You know, the truck traffic is definitely a big major concern, not only with that, but we also have another area that's bringing in truck traffic as well. So those are good things. You guys did really good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, too. I think you've been very professional in your acting this afternoon. And I agree with Tammy. Transportation issue is the biggest thing that we as the City of Black Diamond have going for us right now. And, you know, we're working with the state and with the county to try and get some improvements out here, too. But the Office of Surface Mining is one that's ultimately responsible for that permit. It's really outside of the responsibility of the City of Black Diamond or the City Council. Although we've had citizens come in when this came back up again a few months ago. So, yeah, I think congratulations. I think you're on a really good path, and Wazoo's a really fun place to go visit. Yeah.
So I would also say, you know, like blasting, you know, you kind of touched on that. You know, how are they going to have for citizens to contact, you know, if something happens at their place or it is really loud? You know, what's their number going to be? Where are they going to post all that?
Well, it's not determined fully yet because it's not reopening, you know, for sure. I mean,
right.
But it's going to be limited, so the
Well, I just wanted to point out that on March 15th, Pacific Coast Coal Company issued a letter to residents in the area, and I wasn't sure that you knew that they are going to start blasting.
Yeah, I actually got that letter last night. Yeah.
So you guys did a great job. Good luck at Wazoo. One other thing to think about, right? There are bodies of water and wetlands in that area that could also be contaminated during that. As Janie mentioned, the City Council did send a letter of no support to that, but it's not our jurisdiction, right? So unluckily, we wish we could do more about it, but it's one of those things that we're all going to have to live with. So.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know if Chief Smith can do as good as they did, but yeah. Chief Smith is going to give us a tutorial on fire apparatus 101.
Maybe you can get them to help you.
I did ask him if they were going to protest, given I have a fire hose. So tonight I just have I'm hoping to do this 10 minutes or less. This kind of presentation. You know, when you see a fire engine, that's usually what you see, the outside. So if I, you know, decompose a fire engine and show you what it looks like inside the car, and what's with it, because at some point you're going to see the price of the fire engine.
Well,
what the heck? Why does this thing cost so much? So that's what, and I don't know either that costs so much. But,
the lasers really don't work on TVs.
Oh, okay, that's right. So all of the fire apparatus you see up here are now or were once Black Diamond Fire Department apparatus. So these are your two current apparatus, engine 98, engine 981. And this one actually is out of service now. And we know where this one is. That's sitting over at Station 99 in the back room. And these are two of your older fire apparatus. There's one. I was trying to find a picture of one because I know where I'm working now, back in 90-something, they brought this rig in. They said, oh, here's our new engine. We just have to have a payment. And I went, and they got it from District 40. And I said, yeah, I remember. I was still in high school when they got it. So a lot of your fire, all the only new one, I think, that you've ever bought, that the department's ever had, was Engine 98. I think everything else has always been used. In fact, rather well used. In fact, this was a kit fire department. Rig. And it had actually been in a rollover accident before it was compared to me. They sold it to you guys. So.
That's the laser.
So now comes nothing. Now it's nothing moving again. Did I turn it off?
I see a laser.
No, we didn't. We tried it.
It worked. We tried it and we got it to work.
Okay, well, you want to disadvance it?
Yeah, I'll try to work on it and see what I can figure out.
Let them escape.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sure, you guys don't want that. You guys speed it up, Chief.
There we go.
Okay. Okay.
Lisa went to the next frame.
All right. Let me see about this. So there's a couple different ways you can buy a fire press. You spec a custom built, or you buy one that's already built, and it's typically on a chassis as a commercial chassis. So when you custom built, this is where you start. You start with your diagrams, and when you end up with the fire engine, when you're done. So what we're looking for is something that will hold a crew of 4 or 6 firefighters, has to have a breathing apparatus, has to carry like 700 to 1,000 gallons of water, has to have a foam system for both A and B foam, might have about 1,000 feet of fire hose supply line, that's the large diameter, like we blocked the highway with the other day. Also have to have about 1,000 feet of fire attack hose. Usually carry 2 ladders, a 24 and a 14, and tools and more tools. If you give a firefighter a room on fire apparatus, they'll put a tool in. So there's typically not much room left after that. So we also respond to EMS calls in our fire apparatus. We don't take an aid car because if you have 3 guys at a fire station and they go on an aid call, they take the ambulance. Now they're on their way back and we have a fire. What happens? We got to go all the way. So we take a fire apparatus, and it has every single piece of equipment that's in an aid car is on the fire apparatus except for a stretcher. So the ambulance comes and takes them. So we also have that room for all the EMS supplies. We also have to look at maximum weight because with riches and the state will actually, I know of a fire department not too far from here in Chuck Willow. They had to get a special, they had a brand new aerial, and they couldn't use it because it weighed too much. So, you know, $1.5 million. So you don't want to have it weigh too much. Maximum height, why do we do that? So we know we can get it in the fire station. The first thing we do is, how big is that door? Because there's also been cases where, well, you can call a fire department, why bring the fire engine? Then we back in, oh, it doesn't fit, in the firehouse, so it's a good thing to measure before you build. They'll measure twice, cut once. Maximum length, typically 37 feet long. Maximum width, usually about 20 foot length wide ropes, right? So anyway, we spec all that stuff out. So this is kind of what it looks like inside of the fire. So. Chassis, this is the first thing that they put together is a chassis. They built that from the ground up. So then we have a power plant, typically a diesel, a large diesel. This is an alternator. That's a $2,500 alternator. That's what goes in fire press. Why? Because there's so much electrical stuff going on in campus. Go ahead and chucks and put an alternator. Transmission, automatic. Everything used to be stick, right? The old days. And so you had to double clutch them, and they were really hard to drive. And now we have firemen come in, and they've never even driven a clutch before, especially volunteers. It's really hard. So everything now is pretty much an automatic transmission. Fire pump. Like I said, fire pump, anything we want to pump from like 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 gallons per minute. So this is kind of what the fire pump looks like. These are, this is called the area on the outside is called the Lulu. There's an impeller right here. The fire comes into the eye of the impeller. The impeller turns around through centrifugal force, goes to the outside, increases the pressure, and comes out up there. This one is a dual stage pump. So you can get a dual stage, you put it in the pressure, and you get a lot of pressure, but not so much water. So it puts the water into this balloon, into that one, then brings it over to this one, increases the pressure, and shoots it back out. Most of the time, nowadays we're looking at single stage pumps, most of the time nowadays. This is a transfer case down below. So when you pull up to a fire, you operate some functioning things in there, and it takes the power from the motor away from the rear end and puts the power into the pump to operate the pump. So the same engine's good. Some fire trucks, especially wildland trucks, you can pump and drive at the same time, but it's a different process. Okay, phone system. Not all fire trucks have phone systems. We like to put them in there. There's a couple of reasons. One is Class A phone, and that's for ordinary combustibles, house fires, brush fires, those type of things. And then a Class B phone, you can't use water on a flammable liquid fire. You have to use foam, so that's what a Class B phone is. So you can, two types of foam, you just switch it over which one you want, and we can have foam come out of the end of the fire hose. So this is typically kind of what the apparatus body looks like when we put them together. Water tank. Water tanks used to be made of metal, now they're all made out of plastic. And so and it's really kind of cool because they can shape that tank so it fit inside there with all, there's so much plumbing and electrical wires and everything else and pipes. So they can actually have one where they cut a hole in like this, and it's all sealed. But from the back of the fireplace, you open the door, and the ladder goes in there. It actually goes right through the middle of the tank. It's a lot more effective.
And they're baffled inside, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you baffle the tanks because when water splashes around, it's not good.
Yeah.
Water weighs more than gas. A gallon of water weighs more than a gallon of gas. Yes. 8.33 pounds per gallon. Rollover protection and other devices. They actually have an electronic stability control device on the fire apparatus now. Right about the middle of the fire engine, there's a gyro that sits there. And it can tell if you go off the side of the road to the shoulder, it can tell it's doing this. It'll start doing the step, braking and doing stuff like that all by itself. It's a rollover prevention device. And a lot of vehicles are now using vehicle data recorders, speed, location, all those type of things. Then they can take the chassis and they mount it with the body. Here's an old fire pump panel. That's what they used to look like. This is what they look like now. But, fairly complicated. So that's how we operate the pump. Tilt cap, if you have the cap sits up, you have to tilt it up so you can get to the engine. Okay. Compartmentation, really, really important. In fact, that's probably the most important thing in the fire. What compartments look like, where we're going to store all our stuff. So even recently, we've even come up with, we're using every single square inch that we can find, so we even started putting compartments around the wheel wells. It used to be just there was nothing there, so we said, well, why not put something in there and put a door on it, you can stick stuff in there. So that's what we do. You see all the different tools. We can't say, we got to go back to the fire station to get a tool. We like to have all that. This is what we've been doing on our new apparatus. Like, remember I told you, we also use them as an aid card. So this is, if you look at the outside, there's a roll-up door. You open it up, here's all of our aid equipment. And you can also access it from the inside of the table. We're using roll-up doors now a lot more. We used to use the fold-up doors. And you know what happens to the foot when you leave those open?
Yeah.
You know, we got that down at Station 99, when you left door open, and
they
got the whole front of the fire station.
So. You get a new head injury patient.
Didn't even dent the fire. So the roll-up doors are really nice. You roll them up, not in the way. This is, I went out and took some pictures of the cab yesterday, one of the rings, so lots of stuff going on. You can see, everything's battery operated now, so we have battery. These are, you see a bank of batteries up there, that's our portable radio batteries. There's the cab up front, you know, probably more stuff sitting in there than there is in a cockpit of an airplane. So. Hose bed. There's a rear hose bed. So, looking at this truck right here, I'd say it doesn't carry a lot of water because you can see how low the. If you look at our trucks that carry 2,000 gallons of water, that big box full of water is there, so the hose sitting way up there, and it's really hard for guys to get up there and pull that hose down. So we're trying to fix that a little bit. The hose from the back, and then on the side we have crossways. These are hoses that are already hooked up to the pump, so all you have to do is pull them out and pump water to them right. So, you know, gosh, why does it cost so much? Okay, here's a seat. That's what a seat costs for a fire. $1,400. Because they're what we call them smoke seats, right? Because their breathing apparatus is in there. So when they go sit down on the way to the fire, they put the breathing apparatus on, so when they get out, they're ready to go. When I was in the fire service, we rode the back of the fire. So we don't let anybody do that. We expect the kids to want to do that. And the breathing apparatus, we put in a box. And, you know, the second or third engine company that came in would put a breathing out. The rest of us wouldn't end without it. So that's why a lot of firemen are dying, especially older guys, dying from cancer now. So this is an NFPA compliant helm holder. So, you know, we used to take our helmets and there'd be a hook in the cab, and there's a little thing on the back of it, you just hang it up there. Can't do that anymore. It has to be in an FPA compliant helmet, because when you get an accident, all that stuff goes flying. So, some of the manufacturers, E1, Pierce, Rosenbauer, Spartan, and Toyo. This is fairly new. They're out of Idaho. That's a fairly new. And those are the ones we're going to be looking at. In fact, they have specifications and pricing for all of those. So we're looking at $600,000 to $700,000. And we also have to pay sales tax. I've been fighting that for 20 years because there's really about four states in the United States that makes the fire department first pay sales tax. So the citizens give us money to provide fire protection. We buy a $600,000 fire engine, and we give the state $40,000 or $50,000. We could buy a bunch of equipment, so it doesn't make a lot of sense. So anything you can do to stop that,
yeah,
do it.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we've been looking at a lot is piggyback purchasing. That's where you purchase off of someone else's bid, and so that really saves a lot of time and energy. Everybody's doing it now.
Right. Yeah.
We used to write our own specifications, go out to bid, then open them up, and do all this, and then the guy right next door would be doing the same thing. So and the state allows this. So usually we award a bid, one that meets the specs, the lowest cost, doesn't necessarily have to be the lowest cost, one that the performance, in other words, they met our bid specifications. Warranty, typically you'll see a 10-year warranty on fire apparatus. And service, we always like to say, if the only dealer for Fords was in Idaho, would you drive to Idaho and buy a Ford And every time you need to have it fixed, if you drive to Idaho, you have it fixed. So what we'll try to do is look for one of these manufacturers that has some place, at least local, that we can take it in for warranty work.
Hey, if you buy it in Idaho, do you have to pay the sales tax?
Yes, because they pay it.
Yes.
When you bring it back here and get your license, that's when you pay your sales tax. So, and I'll tell you a story with that, too, because one of the fire departments that now is a part of us was south of there, and we tried to light, we were doing something with one of their engines, and they said, well, this isn't even, it had a license plate on it. But it wasn't registered with the state, so what they did is they brought it here, they put a license plate on it and said, we're good to go. I mean, who's going to check the license on the firing? So they never did a sales tax. So we could just switch the plates out.
You're not supposed to say that on a recording.
So
you didn't hear that, dude.
A contract, so you do a pre-construction meeting, you meet with the people that are going to be building it, and it's a 2 or 3 day process. And then you actually go back to the plant mid-construction. You go back before they seal it up. This is kind of like when you do a building inspection, right? If I'm going to go and inspect the wiring, and all the walls are on, I'll say, okay, now how am I going to inspect the wiring? So you go back for a mid-inspection, and that's before everything's all closed up. And then you do a final inspection and acceptance. Go back to the plant again and do that. So one of the questions is how do we get it from point A to point B? So they can pay somebody to drive it out, or you can send somebody back and drive it out. I prefer to let them bring it to us and don't accept that rig until it's here. Because that way, if they're driving it out here and it rolls down a cliff and it's destroyed, it's not ours, it's still yours. So that's why I don't like to accept them until they're here at our fire station. And then we do an acceptance test, a pump test, and do all that stuff, make sure it's copacetic. Take possession, usually about a 10-year warranty. Well, we are going to look at Puget Sound Fire. That's Kent Fire. We're going to look at one of their specifications, and we already have a Mercer Island. That's that $700,000. I think we can do better than that. So we're going to set that one aside. Another thing we're looking at is it's not a company. It's called Sourcewell. It's out of Minnesota, and it is a government agency in Minnesota. That's all they do is, it's kind of like you can buy stuff off state bid, right? This is kind of the same thing, but it's in, there are no firecrafts on Washington state bid. This is a Minnesota thing. And it's actually governed, it's a government agency. So all they have to do is sign an agreement with them, and you can purchase off of theirs. And they have all of those manufacturers that I showed you, they have a contract with each one of those. So we're looking at those now. And those were just open on March 1st, so that's what we just got them. In fact, we were talking about this Tuesday, we didn't have that information. Next day, the emails came, so now we have that information. So that's kind of where we're at. I think that's it. Are there any questions on that?
One thing, when you talked about the fire truck having all the emergency EMS equipment on there, I don't think a lot of people understand that District 44 doesn't transport people to the hospitals. It's
we call it a private ambulance.
Right, yeah. A private ambulance comes in and does that for you. So, just like Chief Smith said, you know, you want your fire truck out there on calls, on emergency calls as well, in case there is a fire call or an auto accident or something. So they're prepared for that.
No, that's what you know, if you're gonna roll two different rigs, you're gonna have more people.
Right.
And that's what costs money, is paying for all those firemen all the time.
And usually the local fire department can get to the scene quicker than a paid ambulance.
Oh, yeah.
They're closer.
Yeah. And also, if we get there, we treat them. If it's an advanced life support, and we call in an ALS unit, which is out of our station. Nearest one is Station 94 down by Crane's Corner. And that's the King County Medic unit. There's another one in Covington, and there's one in downtown Auburn. Those are the closest ones. But the closest one here is straight up the highway. So, and it's actually stationed at one of our fire stations.
So we are in the process of buying a fire engine, like Chief Smith said, but the ad hoc committee has talked about it, and as the council has. When you mentioned about riding on the back of the fire engine, when I was on in 89 or 90, that was the big thing is, you know, you hop on the back and you hold on for dear life in your bunker gear. And, right, I don't think that was very safe then. No. But it was interesting.
We used to hold each other on.
Right?
Hold like this and put your arm around the guy like this, yeah. And then put the gear on and he'd hold you on. And you know, you're standing on something this wide. And
yeah.
That's scary. Nice. And, you know, I was really tall, so those beds were here. So I was getting all the rain and the snow. And so had the fire. When we first bought a fully closed fire engine, one fire mechanic said, you know, Chief, you need to have heat in it. It's very cold back then. So most of the when you buy a new fire apparatus, we pull all the equipment and hose off the old fire apparatus and put it on. You don't buy all new equipment. You don't do that. So put it all on that brand new piece of equipment. Okay, so I'm hoping the next couple weeks we'll have this pinned down and know which one to buy and start that process.
Thank you.
Well, then after we get the new fire apparatus, how do you retire out these old ones? Do you surplus them and then
give it back to the city? City mm-hmm. surpluses it.
And some.
We used to, third world. I don't think you're going to sell any of yours.
Probably.
They used to do slash pile burns, right? In the old days, they don't do that anymore. And most of the people used to buy our old fire trucks.
Oh.
So there's not much of a market anymore.
Gotta get all the preppers that buy them and turn them into off-road or prepper camper kind of things. They take the body off and put a new body on.
They're tired.
You too. Pinterest.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Smith.
Pretty soon we'll have it pinned down. And
hey, good luck at Wazoo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I gave you legal some information I kind of looked at. Because, you know, one of our goals is we want to get a good fire apparatus at a good price to be able to pass the state audit. So that's what it works.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. The next item on the agenda is the consent agenda.
I make a motion to accept the consent agenda.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So we have a public comment period. So if you are interested in talking to council, please step up to the microphone and state your name and city of residence and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Is there anyone wishing to address council? Seeing no one, we will close this public comment session. We have a public hearing tonight. It's a continuation of the proposed ordinance number 191120 regarding code revisions to Chapter 1850, accessory uses and structures, and Chapter 1856, accessory dwelling units. Ms. Kincaid.
Good evening and thank you, Mayor, Council members. So this is a continuation of a hearing that we opened or that you opened on March 7th to take public testimony on proposed revisions to some code sections, chapters, in Black Diamond Municipal Code, Chapter 1850, which is titled Accessory Uses and Structures, and 1856, Accessory Dwelling Units. At that time, you had a draft ordinance with the proposed attachment A to the ordinance, which showed the strike through and underlined format of the proposed changes. Tonight we handed out an ordinance that David Linehan, after doing legal review, he made some revisions to that ordinance, adopting ordinance. And then I've also handed out an Exhibit B to the ordinance. After getting legal review, David had some just terrific detailed legal questions about making the language clearer and better. So in this Exhibit B to the ordinance, I have on the left-hand side showed you in a clear format what the attachment A to the ordinance reads and what we would propose to revise, so that you can see that it's not particularly big changes in terms of the things that we discussed, the policy level things that we discussed, but more legal changes. That the first one that you see in 020A in the revised is that David's brought up. We had that they had to be built, the accessory structures and uses had to be built in conjunction with the primary use, but actually they could be established concurrent. So, you know, that's that first one where it's clearly someone could be doing them both at the same time. We wouldn't make them, oh no, if they bring a building permit in and a garage, you know, you have to have the house built first, and then, so that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The 020C change is that David pointed out, where in you see the left-hand draft language, we say that no accessory structure shall be larger than the ground floor area of the primary structure, but we didn't really define what we meant by that, so that, mm-hmm. that makes it difficult for people to understand what are you talking about. Okay. So in the right-hand corner, the right-hand column, the revised section, we define that ground floor area as the total area of each floor level of the primary structure. So we're talking perimeter area total. So if they maybe have added on, then we would count the total floor area for that. The third change from the ordinance that you had on March 7th is to 1850-020-D1, and that is where we wrote that to assure that an accessory structure is, you know, the harmony and aesthetics with the surrounding area. David said, well, really, that's kind of nebulous and vague. We should look at the surrounding structure or structures. And I think that makes a lot more sense for the administration of this code. Mm-hmm. And then we dropped at the last sentence where we said, or an accessory dwelling unit structure. That just plain didn't make sense because it wasn't consistent with the rest of the code. So this internal consistency check is so important to have. I wish that I had had time to get that to him before you had the ordinance in front of you 2 weeks ago. 1850-020-E1A public hearing draft side, you can see that language, and then if you look over to the far right, I've sort of had to define the total area because the question posed on the way the language reads in the March 7th draft, hearing draft, is what happens if you have, is the 650 square feet, what are we talking about again? I mean, are we talking about, what if it's two-story? How are you actually defining that? And so we're saying 660 feet because this is this setback, it's not a variance, but it's sort of a setback exemption for smaller lots, for smaller units. If it's 650 square foot in floor area is how I said it, but I'm saying it's the total area of each floor level, so it's consistent again with the way that I'm defining it in 020C. So if the total area of each floor level of the building is no greater than 650 square feet, just clarifying language there. 50030A4, if you look over to the revised, I just added a sentence including any residents of the ADU because I neglected to put that in there. We do mean to include that as well, and I omitted it on the last one. Second page, 1850030A12B. This was some language where we talked about how a guest room couldn't have a kitchen because if it had a kitchen, it wasn't a guest room. It could be turned into an ADU. And the legal voice here says, ooh, you're going to have a little trouble with that language, with the kitchen language. So I changed it to say that the guest house can contain living and sleeping spaces, including a bathroom, but it cannot have cooking range and/or oven and stove top. I didn't want to add the whole suite of refrigerators because what if they want to put a little compact fridge and it's kind of, you know, it gets so really, I think that we'll be in pretty good shape because cooking range, oven and stove top is something that if you're going to have a kitchen, you're going to have it. If you're going to have like maybe a little mini fridge or maybe a microwave, that's not really a kitchen. So hopefully that will help us as we administer that code and avoid some of the confusion that people run into when they're trying to do things. 1850040, I had tried to make it really simple, and in trying to make it simple, I made it much worse. So I went back over to the revised section, to the old language, where I had struck that and tried to be more all-encompassing. But this is reverting back pretty much to the way that the ordinance read originally, where we talk about the A and B, which are those specific accessory uses allowed in the neighborhood commercial. For some reason all I can think is Crossroads Commercial, but that's not it. CC, thank
community
you.
Commercial.
The community commercial and the town center commercial zone. So this is language that reverts back to the way that the old ordinance read. 1856010B, I just added again that any combination thereof that meets the definition of the ADU, it's just clarifying language, that last sentence, as well as the section B below it with in C, that meets the definition of an ADU, just added that sentence. Page 3, when we look at the 1856030B, it was just a little better way to say that we, in the revision, that adequate provisions, I was sort of weak in my language there on what I was proposing, and what we're going to say is that adequate provisions for water and sewerage must be met, not, you know, a sort of what I had before as it may be or as provided in. This is much clearer. You gotta meet it. Then in 56030C, just added some language to that last sentence, the ADU from the principal dwelling, or violate, so they can't separate the ADU from the principal dwelling or violate applicable lot coverage or setback requirements. More boots and suspenders kinds of language here. And then 1856040C, I just removed the last sentence that was proposed because it didn't make sense. It was sort of a dangling thought. And so you see now that it's the code section would just end with we'll notify any prospective purchasers of any conditions as imposed as part of the ADU approval. And I dropped that with the requirements of continued use because it didn't make sense. So that is what I'm bringing forward to include as an exhibit to the ordinance. If I could answer questions.
I don't even know if it's a legal question, but is must and shall the same?
Generally, yes. Shall sometimes has lots of alternative meanings that must does not. So sometimes it's depending on what is meant, sometimes must is a better choice.
Okay. So in my other, just a statement, on 1850.030, on the refrigerator stove thing, when my parents lived with us, they lived in our basement, so they did have a refrigerator and a microwave, so they could make sandwiches or whatever.
Exactly.
But the main meal was cooked downstairs
right.
in my kitchen. So, I mean, I think that, you know, that's fine if you have your own personal refrigerator or microwave to be used. So I like that new language that you put
oh,
in there.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean,
That was the situation we were trying to avoid, was having putting a microwave in. That doesn't turn it into an ADU.
Right.
We don't want
right.
that to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
right.
So that was one point of clarity.
Any other questions on what I've produced? So I would like to enter that into the record for, you know, staff report for the hearing. And then since this is a continuation of the hearing, we would want to see if there's anyone else that's here this evening that would like to give testimony.
And just for one last bit of clarification, so the new draft ordinance or the new ordinance that was passed around tonight, it includes a reference to this Exhibit B as part of the adopted changes.
Okay.
So just to make sure that the record was clear on that.
Is there anyone wanting to make a statement on the public hearing on the accessory dwelling units? Seeing no one, we will close this public hearing. Do I have any discussion, Councilmember Edelman?
No, I was going to move that we approve the proposed ordinance 19-1120 regarding code revisions to Chapter 18.50, accessory uses and structures, and Chapter 18.56, accessory dwelling units.
Second.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Now we have a resolution approving Oak Point's use of the city's transfer development rights bank and executing a TDR trust agreement with CCD Partners LLC and establishing a TDR transfer fee. Ms. Kincaid.
I'm actually going to turn this over to David Linehan, because he ran the workshop. We'll tag team it, but I think we'll start with David, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Thanks, Barb. You just had a long discussion there yourself, so I'll take some of the pressure off. So the resolution and materials that are before you tonight, Council, are the same documents that we reviewed during the work session a few weeks ago. And I thought that you guys asked a lot of great questions. Seeing as we left that I think everyone seemed to have a good handle on this somewhat arcane and complicated set of materials is. I haven't heard any questions in the meantime, but certainly happy to address them tonight. Just as a very high-level reminder, what this particular resolution would do is really four things. One of the things that it does is to essentially implement some provisions of code that are already there. There's a provision in the code for the TDR bank where the city can hold development rights to be sold at a later date. The city can also act as a trustee using a trust account mechanism so that anybody who wants to sell their development rights now but doesn't have a defined receiving lot to put those on. So the trust account process built into the code solves that timing problem, lets those development rights sit in the bank until there's an actual lot that those can be applied to. In this case, Oak Point is the first entity to come forward and ask to be granted a trust account within the bank. So this resolution essentially authorizes the creation of a trust account for Oak Point to use to hold whatever TDRs it purchases until those TDRs are ready to be applied to a final lot during a final plat application. Second thing that this resolution does is authorizes the mayor to execute a trust agreement, which is attached. And that trust agreement just kind of sets forth the mechanisms, the minutiae of how that in and out process of the TDR trust account will work, as well as provides city approved documentation for the conservation easement that will be placed on the lots that are selling their development rights, and some other documentation that it's important for the city to make sure that it approves of. Third thing it does is authorizes all property owners within the city who have development rights to sell. All of them can participate through this particular trust account process, so that there aren't, you know, favorites being played. Everyone's able and eligible to have their development rights sold and placed into the trust account. And the fourth thing it does is establish a $324 per transaction transfer fee, because the city's going to have to administer the accounting of these sales, and so that reimburses the city at the time of a transaction, the time of a sale. The city gets paid for having to update the database. So if you have other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. Council Member Deedy.
Just a quick clarification. I think I got this, but residents that want to sell here in Black Diamond, they then approach City Hall, the city, and say, I want to sell, or do they approach the developer? And then the developer says, yeah, I want to buy, and then it comes to the city? So, I mean, how do you track who's buying and who's buying what?
Right.
And the city knows that Oak Point has 300 TDRs they're buying this week, mm-hmm. let's just say. How does the city know that's 300 and not, let's just say they come out and say, we're buying 250. I mean, how do you track all that?
So, to answer the first part of your question, the city doesn't get involved in the actual buying and selling process. That's between the selling party and the buying party at Oak Point. So,
now we're the bank.
So we are just, the city in this process would just be holding whatever that sold number of development rights is. So whatever
we provide the permit or the certificate, right? Is that what we talked about, the TDR certificate?
Right. So the way the city keeps track of the actual number that are being bought and sold, before the seller can sell, the seller has to get a certificate from the city that says how many development rights that seller has. The city keeps a database of who has how many. Mm-hmm. And if the seller has, let's just use a round number, has 100 development rights but they only want to sell 50, that number is memorialized, and in your packet, I believe it's Exhibit C, which is the deed of transfer. That's what gets sent to the city and says, we're selling 50 of our development rights, and so we have a record of that. That's also recorded, and other things go along with that. But that's how the city then knows how many development rights to move from account A to account B in the TDR database. Hopefully that answered the question.
Yeah, that was good.
So I have a question. Council Member Oglesby, sorry.
So question. So I understand there will be a fee for us to hold the TDRs in our banks, and that fee is for administrating time to process all the paperwork and everything like that. That's what we're kind of determining and looking at. So once the TDRs are in the bank and maybe a potential buyer wants to buy the TDRs out of the bank, is there a fee that for the TDRs to go certificates to go out of the bank also?
Yes, so there's a couple of fees. There's a couple of fees that are already built into the current code. We're adding one more fee that just, I guess, got overlooked when they were drafting the code maybe the first time. So there's a fee paid when the city issues the development rights certificate.
Okay.
That's the initial process for the city to establish, Mr. Smith has 80 and Mr. Jones has 10 and Ms. Williams has 150 or whatever. So there's an initial fee paid when the development rights certificate is created.
Okay.
Then when there's a transaction between a buyer and a seller of those rights, this fee covers the city's cost of moving those numbers around within the database.
Okay.
Did I answer the question?
Sorry. Yes. And then my other question would be, what's the obligation of how long can those TDRs stay in the bank, and is there a timeout frame? What happens if they're in there too long? Does it fade out? What What happens then?
So really, they don't expire.
Okay.
They just get sold. So I believe the code says, I could probably dig up the language. I believe the code says that once a DRC is placed in the trust, it shall stay there until it is applied to a lot.
Okay.
So basically, once it goes in, it's on the city's database until someone comes and says, move it out of that onto lot 12 in this subdivision. So it's just kind of a holding pen until there's an available lot for it. And I guess, you know, maybe with respect to this particular party, with respect to Oak Point,
right.
You know, their obligation is to use TDRs and achieving their density that they're aiming for in the master plan development. Of course, that agreement, the development agreement, expires in, I believe it's 2027. But those TDRs don't expire in 27. Those are development rights that exist regardless of what's happening in the master plan development. So this trust account will be useful for them during the build-out process, but the TDRs would survive whatever happens with the development.
Councilmember Edelman?
Well, I had some questions about the cost, too. Because we're talking $324 per transaction, and it could be hundreds and hundreds of TDRs. In those hundreds and hundreds of TDRs, can they be multiple people? So if Oak Point is trying to buy these TDRs, and you've got Joe Blow and Susie Smith, and or is it it's one entity, one DRC? Okay.
So that one DRC could have 10, 15, 20, 100, rates with it.
Okay.
It's one DRC.
Okay.
Because
I was wondering if that was enough money to charge.
Yeah, just to finish that off. So if Oak Point is entering into five different transactions,
mm-hmm.
one of them might be five TDR, one might be 100, one might be 50. Each one of those five transactions would require a separate one. Because it's
DRC, yes.
Right. It's DRC related. Okay.
They're maintained in the database by owner. So for each owner, we have to record a transaction that would adjust the numbers.
Yeah, and I just, you know, having gone through the review of the fee schedule a few years ago, I'm kind of sensitive to, does this actually cover the costs of the staff?
We're glad for that, too. Thank you.
Yeah, because...
Yeah, and if we at some point determine that it doesn't, the council can adjust it.
Right. Okay.
So that can be done in the future. We find out
Well, we can adjust the fee schedule at any time.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Good questions. Really good questions.
Councilmember Wisnowski.
I don't have a question. I just want to thank both of you for helping us understand this rather abstract and interesting part of government, right? It's one of those things where you're just like, this has got to be something government thought of somewhere because it's not something that normal people would think of, right? It's one of those things where you're just like, wow, wrapping your head around trading TDRs is, you know, it's like trading Pokemon or something.
Yeah,
it's an interesting way to go. I just want to say thank you both for helping us to get through this. That work study was really helpful to kind of wrap our heads around it. Because when you just read through it, it's kind of dry and you're kind of, it's like I said, it's pretty abstract, right? It's like imaginary numbers in math class when you were a kid, right? Just thank you very much for helping us out.
Welcome. And we appreciate the diligence that you all put into reviewing it. Because it's very apparent both tonight and before that you guys made a real effort to try and wrap your brains around the details of this, and that's to be commended.
Okay, go ahead. I got to find it first.
Do we have any discussion on it?
No. Can I make a motion to adopt resolution number 19-1298 approving the removal of development rights from certain TDR sending sites, authorizing placement of development rights certificates into trust with the city's TDR bank, approving a TDR trust agreement with CCD, Black Diamond Partners, LLC, and establishing a TDR transfer fee.
A second. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I don't believe we have any department reports today. We already heard from the fire department.
He's had his say. It's time for the mayor's report, and on Saturday I attended the legislative review with our Senator Mark Mullett and Representatives Bill Ramos and Lisa Kalan, and there was some people from Maple Valley and a lot of people that were present, and it was interesting. There was a couple of things they didn't have answers for that were brought up. But basically, they gave us a bunch of information on what was going on and how they were voting. And you know, one of our big takeaways was that they're working on trying to get all of 18 as a four-way highway. So I think that was great. Mm-hmm. And then in the afternoon at 1 o'clock was a graduation for the fire recruits, and there were 7 graduates, and it was a very well put together ceremony, and looks like we have a bunch of good recruits, so was really good. Tuesday I attended the skateboard, and it was basically King County Metro Connects and Rapid Ride Service updates. And then at 11:30, there was a mayor's meeting in Tukwila with the South End mayors, and just talking about how we survived the storm and what each city did, and what cities like Auburn and Renton and Kent did when, I mean, they've had some shootings, and how they handle the press, and how they felt that the mayor shouldn't be involved if it's a police action, but the mayor should be involved if it's like a personal action, and that they should be up front. And I thought that was really interesting. And then that afternoon on 319, I met with Reagan Dunn, and we went down to 288 and 169 and looked at the Cedar to Green River Trail, because they have not decided what to do about that intersection. And it's very dangerous because there's no way to get from the south end of the trail to the north end of the trail without going across 288, and there's no crosswalk, and we have no signalization, and we don't know when any of that is ever going to happen. And so they talked about that it might be possible to redirect some of the money for paving, since that's been really controversial about the trail, that they might be able to redirect some money to build a bridge at that intersection and, you know, try to raise some money for paving at some later date. So anyway, they're going to be working on that. And they also looked at the parking lots that are used for the trailheads and talked about maybe considering making them park and rides for City of Maple Valley and Black Diamond, and looking at other jurisdictions and doing that, so that these parking lots that have been made for open space can actually be used for another goal. So they were going to look into that. And and we talked about fish stocking at Lake Sawyer, and so we've been doing a little work on that. So basically it was a really good meeting, and he's going to be back on April 17th for Celebration of Earth Day, and we're going to have a ribbon cutting for the signs, the interpretive signs that we put in the park. And I think that it's the Lake Sawyer Park Foundation that's actually going to put out some press releases, and I'm going to put an article in the newsletter so that we can get people to come and get maybe some people from Chamber to be involved in. We're going to plan on opening the gate so that people can actually park in the park, so that we don't have to park in a parking lot and walk the half mile down, because that would preclude some people from being able to attend, because it's a long walk down the hill. So anyway, we're working on that, and now it's time for council reports, and Councilmember Wisnowski.
We got an update from Seth that we did not get our grant that we went out for the Lake Sawyer Park for the Frisbee Golf. So we'll be circling the wagons and reconvening and seeing how we can either find additional funds or
some type of funding somewhere for that, or redo the plan, or maybe try again next year?
Well, I heard back from Leah today, and she had said that they don't know if the disc golf is good for getting kids out of their house, that it involves like older people and not young kids, and so they are questioning if that's a good use of this grant money or not. So
okay. We had a planning committee meeting today where we talked about a myriad of stuff with Barbara. A lot of the ADU stuff, we kind of went over that real quick because we've been talking about that over and over, as well as the comprehensive plan and all those kind of things. So that was a good meeting. I did quickly attend the Black Diamond Elementary kindergarten orientation that was going on this evening because my daughter will be attending kindergarten this fall. So that was it's always great to see a bunch of little kids starting in you know, our community. So. My wife would be very happy when my daughter's out of the house for a full day, 5 days a week. So, but it was good to see all the teachers there and all the folks in the community and stuff. So, we had the fire ad hoc meeting where we talked about different subjects such as the fire truck as well as the inner, what do we call that thing? Inter-local agreement? Yeah, ILA, as well as kind of the whole annexation process and timelines and stuff like that, right? It's one of those things that doesn't happen overnight, and we need to think about it long-term and that kind of stuff. So, I think that's about it.
Councilmember Deedy?
So I attended the ad hoc meeting, attended finance meeting. The last council meeting, I talked about council retreat. We all seem to have agreed that we need one. I'm not sure, Brenda, if I just ask everybody to email you what dates would be good in May, I'm thinking, not next month, but maybe May. Maybe we could send Brenda what dates are good, and then we can go through, figure out when to schedule that around.
Are you talking like during the week?
Yeah, during the week is fine, whatever works for everybody. The fire department recruit ceremony I attended, well done. They're seven, I think it was seven, right? They looked like they were ready to start right away. They were all very pleasant. I went up and talked to a couple of them, like about four I got to. But I thought that the ceremony was very well done. So thank you for inviting us. And I think the bridge is the best choice over 288, 169 there. And I think we've been talking about that for, gosh, maybe 6 years at our Tri-Cities meeting. Every time they talk about parks, we bring that up. Park and Ride, I think, is an excellent idea at the open space. Disc golf, when I heard you mention that, Chris, but at the last council meeting, I wasn't so thrilled. I didn't think that was something that really needed to be put out in the park. I think that, and I mentioned before that having a flyer go out to our citizens and ask, you know, what do you want? You know, I mean, I didn't even know how much space the disc golf takes, what area it was going to be in or anything. I do think, you know, one thing that the city needs and I think would draw in more people, I see all over Facebook everybody asking, where's the dog park? Where's a dog park? And everybody's trying to find one that's suitable for them. I think that's something that the city could certainly use to draw in people from surrounding areas. And maybe, you know, that's something we can look at before maybe another entity takes that on. And we lose that opportunity to bring more people into our area.
Yeah, I think the plan that we had looked at, we were trying to figure out how to do the disc golf along with like a ball field, along with some parking and that kind of stuff. So yeah, we were open to designs. It wasn't a solidified thing. Yeah. So, but it wouldn't take up the whole area of the disc golf field.
So. Councilmember Oglesby.
Were you done?
Yeah.
Okay. I attended the work study last week where we talked about the comprehensive plan and updating that.
attended the town hall meeting where we had a few citizens concerned about some biking issues, bicycle issues and things like that, and how we can better help our town hall meetings with conversations and the dialogue of it. Today, attended the planning community meeting with Chris and with Barbara, where we discussed a lot of the TDRs, and yes, it's a lot to wrap your head around that has been hurting the last 2 days, just kind of absorbing what TDRs and what the purposes of those are, and it's a lot of eye-opening education, for sure. I attended the Black Diamond Museum today, where the Four Culture was there talking about how, what is your culture in your town, what do we represent. They are a, Four Culture is, it says here on their card that we are your King County Culture Funding and Support Agents. And we are working better to understand how culture is doing in your region and in our city. They are asking for our help, and we'd love to hear back from community members, groups, and how they can help us in our culture, our mining, and how we can better make our city more culture in that sense. There is a study and there is a site you can go to. I'll leave these little cards out. They gave these to me to give to you guys. It was a good conversation on what's bringing people, or the culture of Black Diamond, what's drawing people in. Is it the mining? How is it? How are we making it better in our community? How is it looking in our community? But it was a good conversation, and there is a good survey on there, and they would love your guys' input, how they can better help us create, I keep on saying culture, but yes, the style of our culture of our city and how we can make it better. But yeah, that information I'll leave on there for you guys to take and look at. There is some, I was noticing on the website that I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but the civil service vacancy notice is up there, so that spot is available and you can go online and apply for that spot. It does look like the Maple Valley and Black Diamond Chamber of Commerce is doing, I'm hoping that maybe local businesses will start joining more of the Black Diamond Chamber of Commerce so we can get more involved with that side of the area. My other point I have here is that the Kiwanis Club, the Black Diamond Maple Valley, is having their Flapjack fundraiser this Saturday the 23rd from 9 to 11 at the Applebee's in Covington, so it'd be nice to support them. Which they, again, come back and support our local community and our community center. Other than that, just a shout-out to the Black Diamond PTA plant sale. So if your little kids are around town or run around selling plants, support them because it goes right back to the community. The plants are coming from GE&B, which I'm super excited for. So that's nice. Some things I have to say. That's it.
Councilmember Edelman.
I went to the Public Works meeting last week. We were talking about utility code updates and also right-of-way permitting. Went to the work study, the town hall with our legislators. My only comment about them, they're all very gung-ho right now. I hope they actually walk the talk. My fear is that they tell us as citizens one thing and they vote something else. But it was very encouraging, especially with Bill Ramos, because he's on the Transportation Committee for the House, and he is just pushing Highway 18 every chance he gets. So that's really good. I also went to the volunteer fire graduation. That was a class act. And I don't know where you're finding these babies, but they're awfully young people. But they were fabulous, and I think they're just going to be a great addition to our fire department. And also I met with the mayor and Reagan Dunn at the 288th and 169 thing. I am really encouraged with how engaged Reagan Dunn is. He wants to help us. He not only was coming up with suggestions for maybe a bridge for the trail, Carol talked to him about the weir and what we can do about the Lake Sawyer Covington Creek weir, and he's just coming up with some maybe creative ideas for helping us out. So I appreciate that he's there for us. And that's about it.
Councilmember Staff.
I attended the Public Works meeting and the Finance Committee meeting. I also attended the Saturday morning town hall with Mark Mullett, Lisa Callen, and Bill Ramos. The two newly elected people, Ms. Callen and Mr. Ramos, just seemed like they really knew what they were talking about, like they have hit the ground running and they are sitting on their committees and working. And I was pretty surprised that there were some people who asked questions about the Enumclaw Building Materials Recycling Center that's proposed, and not a one of them knew a thing about it. They had no idea what they were talking about. So I know that those people who are very concerned about that will inform them, because everyone was kind of flabbergasted that they all just said, gosh, I don't know, but composting is good, but that's not a composting facility. So that was really interesting to just kind of get up close and listen to them. And I was glad that we had the morning session, because, boy, they talked for an hour straight, and they did three of those that day. And so we had the first, we got them fresh before lunch, so that was a good opportunity. I attended the new recruit graduation at the fire station. I'll tell you what, Chief Smith looks pretty spiffy in his nifty outfit. Yeah, he looks like he's ready to set sail. And those seven recruits just looked like they were ready to go. They actually did have a little bit of like exhaustion. And you could see, like, we've gone speeding right up to the line and here we are, and they were really proud of themselves. And I was really impressed that all seven of them had their family members there. There wasn't a loner, you know, amongst the group. They all had family support, which I thought was really great. And my husband was a volunteer firefighter in a very different kind of a program years ago, so I know that it just takes a lot of effort. And we sure appreciate our first responders, our fire service. And little did I know that less than, well, yeah, one day later, pretty much to the hour, somebody called 911 for a member of my family who was treated ALS and airlifted to Harborview. So we were like, oh yeah, remember those firefighters? Yeah, they're like on duty saving lives the very next day. I don't know if any of, no, I don't think it was our firefighters, but it was a pretty big deal to our family and still is. I'm thinking about the town hall meeting last week that we held, not the state representatives one. We had a comment about the bike lane leading into the roundabout, the current roundabout. And my family and I drove up there to really scope that out. And honestly, it really does look like a hazardous turn. And if you're cruising along in the bike lane and you don't really want to enter the roundabout as a bicycle rider, you're almost going to have to come to a screeching halt to take that little ramp. So I don't know if something different could be considered in another design. I mean, I'm sure not a designer, but it was it's very sharp, a very, very sharp turn. They can just continue on and ride through the roundabout, which I think is probably what most of them do. But really, truly, if you take a look at that, it is a really sharp turn. So,
well, they're not supposed to ride their bikes on the sidewalk, so they're supposed to get off their bike and walk it down the sidewalk or stay in the traffic lane.
Well, like I said, they would have to come to a screeching halt, which could be, I drove through there the Sunday morning, and there were about 12 bicycle riders going along, and they seemed to navigate it pretty well, but they didn't use the little ramp. So
we actually brought that up in the planning committee meeting today, and that's by design to make them stop.
Okay. Yeah.
So they don't ramp onto the mm-hmm. into the sidewalk at full speed, I guess.
Anyway, it's a pretty interesting detail, and I guess bike riders need to be informed and know what they're supposed to do when they get to those points. My last comment is about the council retreat. I did send my availability in to Brenda last week, but I also know that right now our staff, our city staff, is pretty busy, for lack of a better word. They're very engaged in doing whatever it is that they need to do. And I'm wondering if we can't address a lot of the issues that we would deal with at a council retreat in these meetings, if we can take them piece by piece and discuss, have discussions about things that we have coming up. I don't know if it means a work study, or if we can deal with some of those issues on a council agenda. I'm not sure, but it just seems like the staff is pretty busy right now. So
well, and the other issue too is we're hiring 4 new people, and now we have another person out sick that is the deputy finance director. Right. And it doesn't look like she's going to be coming back anytime soon. And so,
I guess that's my point, that the staff is stretched pretty thin. Yeah. There's a lot of business going through the city offices right now in several different departments. And we do have new staff, and we're going to have more new staff. So that's just my comment about council retreat. I'm certainly happy to attend, but I'm just thinking of being considerate of staff in what we're asking of them.
I just would like the council not to lose itself and understand that the council needs to get together and work on issues as well. A work study is fine. We'll still need staff, so that will be taking them at night for a work study. A work study would probably be a couple hours, and we could all bring issues and try to figure it out. Generally, at a council retreat, we formulate what we want to talk about. We get that all out. Staff shows up. They help us get that ball rolling and understand where the council wants. So we need to have a direction to go. And right now, this council has no direction. We're just kind of fumbling through right now. We're not saying, here's where we want our park services to go. Here's where we want, code enforcement. We don't have anything saying, Barb, we want you to take, we're going to give you $300,000 to go, do whatever with people that are doing code enforcement, that are doing code violations. We don't have anything stipulating that. I mean, there's a lot of things we're not doing right now, and that we didn't do when the previous council was here. Last year was all about just getting you three up to speed, not bombarding the staff with everything. So I'm just trying to get a feeling for myself of where this council is going, because I don't know what any of us are going.
Well, we did have a council retreat last year, and
that was for staff.
It was to get all the new people up to speed on what was going on in the city. Yeah. And it had an opportunity for the council to bring up issues, which some of us did, or some of you did. And so there was input by council. Councilmember Edelman?
Well, I've not really voiced my opinion on this too much, but I don't think we need a council retreat. I've been to maybe 3 over the years, and one was even before I got on the council. I would much rather see, if we want to take the time within a meeting to come up with an agenda, to have a work study, let's pick a topic. If we want to talk about what direction do we want the Parks Department to go in, let's set that up as a work study, and we can take the time and sit down and decide what we're going to do.
Okay, so I'll put my information into Brenda and the mayor and get it rolling, but
we need an agenda to start with.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. If we can email Brenda with what our topics are and what days we're available, then we can move forward. And I'm not saying next month, I'm saying a month later. So, if you guys don't want one, if you think what we're doing, we're just waiting for staff to feed us, then fine.
But that's not all bad, because we're looking at now, as we're coming up through the summer, we're going to have a CIP review, I'm sure, aren't we? And a TIP review.
Right. So
and then we're going to get into the budget.
Yeah. So what do you want on that? What do you want? Where do you want your city hall? What do you want?
But see, I personally, this city does not need to have its own city hall.
So So here's our discussions that would be at a council retreat. But I'm willing to do it right here on council, on the dais.
Yeah, just do it here.
We're at a work study. You know, so it's up to you guys. You know, I just put it out there. Nobody's mentioned having a council retreat. Nobody's mentioned, hey, let's get the council together and figure out what our goals are. Nobody's mentioned it. So I'm mentioning it. And whether you guys want to follow through with it is fine. Or we can sit back and just wait and let staff go through their motions and think, I think this is where the council wants us to go. And then they bring it forward and we say yay or nay.
I just don't think it's either or. I don't think it's either, you know, have an agenda and move forward with it or sit back and do nothing. I don't think it's either or.
So what's your suggestion?
Wow.
Right.
That wasn't me.
Just continue as we're doing for the last year and a half?
No, what I said already was that I think that we should come up with a list of things that we want to address and decide how to address them, whether it is at a council retreat, whether it is at a work study, you know, divided up maybe a series of work studies, or put it on this agenda and deal with each individual item as it comes to us on a council, a regular work meeting.
Councilmember Oglesby.
So, I hear what everybody's saying. I understand, you know, being a new council member on this board, you know, it's hard to say what direction we're going to go to, who's guiding us, where we're going. We all have these images when we were running, like what was on our running palette, what were we preaching to our residents as we were running to be elected for these seats. As a new elective, I always look to the staff because I feel like, you know, that's my, where they're feeding me what I need to learn, what I need to know, how to run a city. But I hear you, Tammy, where, I mean, I have ideas and dreams and thoughts in my head to, like, same question as you, where is a city going? I feel that in our committee groups that we're already selected in, it's a good time to use the city staff since they're there already in our committees to maybe if we, and my suggestion would be, like in our committees, like Chris and I would go to Barb and say, okay, these are some of our concerns. We come up with some concerns either from you guys input to us and we talk to city staff and you as well in the financial talk to city staff and work out those questions or have questions that we can talk to them in our committee groups and then maybe bring those questions onto the dais where we can all speak in public. Because I hear what Aaron's saying when we're talking about financial money and time and city staff. I mean, there's a lot of money being spent on the city level, which, you know, could be not needed or not spent and using our time wisely. So I suggest that maybe in our committees, finding out what our personal goals are, talking to city staff then, and then bringing them back onto the dais and maybe putting it onto the agenda. I don't know. Maybe that might be
Councilmember Wisnowski.
What if each of us took and sent Brenda a list of three short-term things we'd like to work on, right? And then three long-term things, right? Because we have to worry about the tactical things as well as the strategic things, right? We need to figure out what's the vision for Black Diamond for 2040, right? As well as how do we deal with issues that we're dealing with every day here, right? So what if we put together a list of three short-term items and three long-term items? And then we try to kind of bring that list together, see where we've got, you know, some of us might have the same things on our list.
Yeah.
And then we schedule some either on the agenda during these meetings or a work study meeting. One of the things that, you know, it kind of tough for us, right, because we had a town hall meeting and we didn't get a lot of input from the citizens, right?
Right.
So it would also be nice to figure out how we can get some input from the staff about what they see as, and I'm not talking about contract issues or anything like that, but in other words, things they see in their department or in their area of expertise that mm-hmm. they may think that would be a good thing to noodle on, right, to get some direction on where are they looking for direction, both short-term and long-term. So maybe if we, you know, put together some lists and send it to Brenda, she could coordinate them, and then we could talk about, do we add it to the agenda of these meetings and then kind of have an open discussion, or do we have a separate work study meeting? If three of us come up with the same topic, right, then we should probably have a work study on that where we can concentrate on that more in a work study meeting.
Yeah, because if you just go to your meetings, like I have finance and I have safety, and if it's just me and Stout going to finance, then we're making, you know, the decisions in that finance. And if it's just me and Melissa going to safety, we're saying, yeah, you know, that's a great idea. But if that information isn't coming back out to the council until a resolution's in front of us, that doesn't make any sense, because we're then not discussing a Frisbee park. That's something that you guys decided and that you wanted. And so it went forward and all the way to looking for a grant for that. And then you were going to get a grant, and then it was going to come forward to council and say, hey, we got this grant, can you accept it? I mean, that puts us at a spot for two council members to say, hey, we got this grant that we knew was going out for, but sorry, the three of you didn't know, but now you know, and here's the grant sitting in front of us. So that, I just want some direction to know, you know, are we all on the same page? Are we moving forward? Are three of us going one way, two going the other? I just want us all to work together and figure this out instead of just having stuff just keep coming at us at a council meeting. So
just to note, the Frisbee golf thing wasn't thought up by Melissa or I. That came to us from citizens and the foundation.
It was the Lake Sawyer Park Foundation.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch, when did that happen? And, right. And did you know that was coming up before? And, you know, is it? So, I mean, there's just a lot of things that, you know, would have, good to have information for. So, you know, right after that meeting, you know, the mayor or somebody could have sent out an all email to everybody and said, hey, Park Foundation came and they want to do this, you know. So I think that's
a good point, right? We don't have a automatic mechanism for communicating what comes out of the committees, right, to all of the council, unless we actually happen to have a conversation with other members of the council. So maybe that's something that we could try to figure out what works best for us, right? Should we have the whoever the staff lead is on those committees, right, publish minutes or publish a synopsis or something? Or you know, because you're right, right? There's only two of us on those committees, right? So, like, I don't know about what's going on in the finance or public works or the safety committees, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I know the planning and the parks work because of those committees I'm on, right? Unless I happen to talk to whoever's on those, right? We don't necessarily, right? If something big comes up, we do a good job of kind of, you know, talking about it amongst ourselves. But if for things like there's a possibility to get a grant that's for active sports and people came to us saying they wanted to do this that are citizens, you know, then it's a thing. So, but I think you made a good point. We don't necessarily disseminate that information as probably as well as we could.
So do we publish the committee meeting minutes?
No. Mm-mm. They're available to anybody who wants them. Each committee chair or each staff liaison is responsible for their own minutes.
Right.
A long time ago, what they used to do at the council meetings when I first started here is each committee chair, we each have committee chairs, and during council reports, that committee chair would give a report of what happened during each committee meeting.
Maybe we just need to do a better job of that in our council reports.
Yeah, so that the community could hear. So, yeah, they would say, you know, as chair, it doesn't have to be the chair now because we don't have that. But one person could take the lead and do that at the council meeting and report on exactly what was discussed at those committee meetings. And then the public is getting that information at the same time. So everybody, it's kind of more transparent that way.
Okay. Okay. Do we have an attorney report?
Well, I'm still recovering from the plat hearing and appeal that went to 2 a.m. last Wednesday. But no, otherwise I have no report.
So now it's time for the second public comments. If you wish to address council, please come up to the podium and state your name and city of residence, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Gary.
Do
Just a comment in regards to the possibility of using the recreational parking at the north end of town for possibly for park and ride. There's not really enough people around there all the time that this would be getting used to where it's going to deter possibly car prowling, that sort of thing. And I'm not sure what it would cost to put cameras out there, or at least a camera trying to cover the whole thing. But it's something to think about, because people aren't going to want to leave their cars where they're that vulnerable. Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to address council? Seeing no one, I will close this public comment. I do not believe we have an executive session, so I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned.